and welcome to the Manchester United podcast, this time on tour.
Manchester United podcast, am I right?
How long have you been thinking about that?
Manchester United.
Yes, podcast. We are in Malta. We're on our travels again. And what a beautiful sight. We're currently at the Marriott Hotel in St. Julian's Bay, looking out at the beautiful seaside. Maisie even looks like he's caught a bit of a tan today.
Well, you know, don't take me long. Those gingers.
Absolutely beautiful place.
Oh, it is. It is so.
And we have had so such pretty. A nice day. Maisie, when was the last time you were in Malta?
December.
Okay.
Prior to that would be, 2010, I think it was. Wow. 2011, so
you're
yeah.
a regular?
Well, yeah, sort of.
Sort of. Sam, I know you were here quite recently as well.
Yeah, I came in November, but I also came here a day ahead of you two. And yesterday I played football against, with the Maltese United Supporters Club, played Bayern Munich. Maybe I've got a video of a goal I scored. Do you want to watch it? You can talk people through it?
No.
Tell them how good it is?
No. Not interested, to be fair.
Go on. You ready? Both posts.
I mean, the goalkeeper.
That was a bit of a toe poke, Sam.
It wasn't. I put my foot through it. Should have expected it.
How was your journey over, Sam?
Yeah, absolutely fine. We should say, I think, that the reason we're here is not just that everyone will know from the episode title to speak to Mick Phelan, but because we're doing a live episode with an audience, which isn't something we've properly done before, which is quite exciting.
No, pretty cool.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it.
We actually spent some time today at the Maltese Supporters Club, where we're going back to tonight. That place
is remarkable.
It's incredible.
Part bar, part museum.
Yeah, like...
The memorabilia
they have.
Wow.
And the pictures on the wall of the players that have been in the Maltese Supporters Club. And the contacts that people have here with ex-players, ex-managers. Oh, it was just such a good day. They took us for a nice lunch as well.
And we should add that obviously we went with them to plant trees for the 65th anniversary of the club being formed. And David May planted the...
I planted a tree.
Named...
The David May tree.
Yeah, the David May tree.
The David May tree.
We all planted a tree. That was it. That was a new pastime for me today.
I've never planted a tree before. I'll come back in next
You've
15
never planted
years.
A tree?
Oh, have
when
you
was
ever
last time you ever
tree?
Planted a tree?
I planted loads of trees.
You liar.
I planted a tree about a week ago.
Just because you look like a tree, that's it. Anyway.
You've got a garden.
Yeah, but I have big trees in it. I mean, I know that really wasn't a big tree today, but, you know, 15 years, that'd be like a big horse chestnut tree.
If they have those here.
Right, so right now, we are about to leave the hotel, head to the Supporters Club in Malta, and we're going to have a live podcast, as Sam said, with Mick Phelan. So enjoy this one.
Okay, Malta, can you hear me? Hello, thank you very much for coming. This is the first time at MUTV we've done something like this, so thank you for being part of this very first live podcast that we're doing. Please welcome to the stage, along with your club president, your hosts for the evening, Sam Homewood, Helen Evans, and David May.
All right, thank you all for coming. This is fun. The three of us have been doing this for a long time now, and this is the first time we've done anything with an audience. So it's really cool to do it, and we really appreciate that you've given up your evenings to come and listen to us talk. Obviously, what we say is the least relevant part of it. And we're going to start with a man you all know very well, Joseph Tedesco. Joseph, thank you for having us. Thank you for helping organise this. For the benefit of people that are listening to this podcast, can you tell us a bit about yourself and also this incredible organisation that is the Maltese Supporters Club?
Thank you for being here. Thank you for inviting me in this great crew with you. I'm Joseph Tedesco. I've been involved in this organization for the past 27 years. In the history of this club, the person in charge, they call him the president. It's a bit of a bombastic name, but I've been in that role for the past 14 years. And I'm privileged and honored to be chosen to keep that role for such a long time.
How many supporters do you have in the club?
We have about 1,000 paid members every season.
How many people fit in here on a Saturday evening or Sunday evening?
We had to do a count, and the best count that we did was the Carabao final last February. It was about 550 people jam-packed here, like sardines. Wow. No tables, no chairs. And our scare was that people had to go to the toilet, and it was not possible even to go to the toilet. It was plus we sent about another 500 back home. You know, unfortunately, or to see it somewhere else. So that was quite a wonderful experience, but with some tension, you know, because when you have all those people here. We had some great nights here. We had the treble in 99. That was amazing. I would say games like Inter in 99 and Juventus in 99, given the rivalry between the English and the Italian fans here, were two of the games which we were like, you know, incredible attendances here.
How often do you get to Old Trafford, Joe?
I try to go at least twice, three times a year, depends. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, not just for games, but we've got loads of friends there. We attend a lot of activities, dinners. We are in very good contact with many organizations like us, you know, who support United. So our network has grown a lot over the past years.
Maisie, I know you've been here before, but for the benefit of people that are just listening, we're in a venue that is purpose-built and owned by the Supporters Club, and it's part bar, part museum. There are photos and memorabilia up in cases and on the walls, and there are pictures of you here from years ago. But have you ever seen anything like it?
No. No, and I've been many, many supporters clubs all over the world. This is unique. I came here 10, 12 years ago, I think it was, something like that. And I was taken aghast by then, but even now, looking at the progress and the size of it now, it's unbelievable. It really is. It's an absolute pleasure to be in. You've done an unbelievable job, and some of the memorabilia is mind blowing. It really is. You've done an unbelievable job. Unbelievable. It's brilliant.
Sam, we need a photo in here. Can we get like a really small photo of us on the wall somewhere?
For sure. We'll be framed.
There's loads
signed,
of amazing.
Framed and signed.
Perfect. Joseph, it is a very special weekend for you. Can you tell people listening or watching what this weekend means to your supporters club?
Yes. Our supporters club was founded in 1959, 1 year after the Munich crash. So this is our 65th anniversary. We have celebrated many anniversaries, the 50th, the 60th, the 40th, 40th, 50th, 60th, and we're doing the 65th with some special activities like this one. For us, it's a privilege to have you here and doing this podcast. We have a program of events. We have had a fantastic exhibition of items unseen, some of them unseen items from a friend of ours from his collection, Joe Glanville. We've opened this exhibition on the Saturday morning, and then following that we went to do, like we did for the 50th, a tree planting event. We planted 65 trees in a wonderful park in a great environment. You were there with us. It was an experience. We have the podcast, we have a dinner after the podcast, and tomorrow we're going to have a mass, the Remembrance Mass, which we do every year. We've been doing it for 65 years to commemorate the Busby Babes, followed by we're going to launch a virtual tour of the Supporters Club, and we're also going to launch for the first time ever a hymn of the Supporters Club, something quite unique.
But obviously our guest for the podcast is someone who's been on the podcast before. Last time we had Mick Finnan on, he just talked about his career as a manager. We're hoping today we'll get to talk to Mick about his time as a player for Manchester United. What does it mean for you and the supporters group and the people of Malta generally when you get people like Mick come to the island?
When Man United people come to the island, for us it's hard work, right? No, it's something which since I was a kid then started to involve myself in the supporters club, it's become like a dream to be involved in organizing these events. So when someone like Mike Phelan is here and Maze is here, you know, these people are players that we watched, supported all our lives. It's obviously a big pleasure for us. It's an honor. Mike gives me a reminder of my first event, which I went as a paid guest of the supporters club in 1991. So I remember me, 20-year-old, going on the small catamaran from Malta to our sister island, Gozo, to an event in Gozo. And Mike was there. I still have the photos with him, so it brings me back a lot of memories. But apart from that, he's been a very essential player in the beginning of the Fergie era. Then he had a great contribution to give in one of our best seasons, 2008, being first team coach. Eventually, he was assistant manager. He's had, a great mentor in Sir Alex Ferguson. He's had a great contribution to give to our football club. So I am very proud that he will be sitting here on this podcast over here in Malta.
Well, in that case, would you like to introduce him for us?
I would like to introduce Mr. Mike Phelan.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good. Good. Good to see you. When was the last time you were in Malta?
91.
Wow.
Long time ago. Lots changed. A lot's changed. We've all got older and wiser.
Was that when Joe was talking about bringing the trophies? Was it that year?
Yeah, the Cup Winners' Cup.
You brought the Cup Winners' Cup?
Yeah, I came out with Lee Sharp and Paul Ince.
Was that a quiet evening?
It was turbulent at times. I brought my wife. Paul brought his wife, fell out with her within 2 hours of landing. And then Lee Sharp brought his girlfriend, right. And he fell out with his girlfriend. So me and my wife ended up babysitting two other people that we'd barely met.
So you're glad to be back in Malta. What a beautiful place. And what do you think of this, by the way?
Oh, this is outstanding. I think you've got
absolutely
to be
incredible.
Extremely proud of yourselves for what you've done here and what you've produced. It's just amazing to look around and all the memories, you know, that just come flooding back to you.
Yeah, I was just going to say, probably
history,
you see things.
Obviously, the history is there, but it's the memories of, you know, people, past, present, you know, and how we've all changed a little bit over the years. But I actually saw a picture there of when I was here in 91, inside the office there. And my wife's on there, so I sent her the picture, and her reaction was, oh, my God. That tells you everything.
I was wondering, for someone like you who's been so involved in the inner workings of Manchester United as a player and then twice as a coach, when you come to a place like this that is a bit removed from Manchester itself, and like even now there's the Munich exhibition and those are the original newspaper articles and all the photos and everything that's here, how does that make you feel? Because obviously you know how big Manchester United is, but when you're in it, do you notice all of this?
You feel it. You definitely feel it, because it's a great honour to be able to associate yourself with not just the football club, but everybody surrounded by that football club and involved in that football club. And it's only until you travel and then you go to places like Malta and other places that you realise how big, you know, the supporters groups are and the club itself. And it is a huge, huge, dare I say, organisation. It's a bit of a monster at times, but it does give you a lot of pleasure to actually meet people that obviously you can't associate with because you're doing your job, and sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, over the years we've got to know you guys here at Malta on regular visits and what have you, but most of the time you're at arm's length all the time. You know about it, but you just can't touch it. Mm. But it's a great feeling to have, that there is lots and lots of history and people that are really red.
And you're joining some of the guys in Munich over the next couple of days. How much does that mean to you to go there and pay your respects?
Well, it's actually a really good honour, to be honest. You hear about it, you hear lots of stories, you talk to people who've done exactly what I'm going to do. Probably quite emotional in many respects, even to this day. Mm-hmm. We are representing an institution and what's come from that. You know, through disaster and devastation to the present day, it's quite remarkable how it's stood the test of time. And just looking around here now, and even behind me and to the side of me, it's just not knowing these people, but hearing so much about them. That's really important. And I think every coach, every player has to put themselves in that position sometimes and feel really honoured that you're representing these guys, these people. You know, and I think that's really important not to forget that.
For the benefit of people listening, the pictures that you're currently referencing are of the Busby Babes. Is that what you mean specifically?
Yeah, Busby Babes is the history. You know, that's part of how Man United has grown from that moment through its tragedy, really. But then it's the follow-on from that. So every time, and this is really important, that even when I was a player, you wear that shirt and it automatically means something that you, you know, there's that great saying, you know, I think the All Blacks used it, you're just borrowing the shirt. It was somebody else's before you. So, and it really is that type of feeling. It's really important to understand that it isn't really your shirt, it's the Manchester United shirt. And I think that's a real thing to not only pass down the line to the academy boys, the people that come in, but also new players when they come in, that they definitely don't realise the enormity of what they're walking into. But when they're there, if they don't embrace it, they're going to struggle, you know. And I think it's passed down through players all the time.
I was going to ask that. How much did Sir Alex and even Ollie, how much importance did they put in letting those young players know? Because, you know, they could be from Portugal, Spain, might not be something they know a lot about. But how important was that education for them?
Yeah, very important, because, you know, players past now, they will still talk about the moment they came to the club. But not only that, it's only until you actually get on that field and then you train and then you embrace all this that you realise that's a fair responsibility. Mm. And then you encourage them to look into the history. It does start at the academy level, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, Paul McGuinness was a great one for making sure that was set in stone for all the young players, you know, obviously through his father and everything like that and through Wolf. So it was really, really important that they understood and embrace the enormity of it, you know, and enjoy the moment, because it is a fleeting moment. I mean, I've been lucky at 22 years or something. I've had, you know, man and boy, you know, I would class myself as a boy at 20-odd when I joined the club, but it's just been a continuation, and I feel really, really honoured that I've had that opportunity to just play, coach, assistant manager over a period of time, and then get the opportunity to go back a second time. So it's pretty unique for me. And I pinch myself sometimes, you know, that's happened.
You'd have had a few years with the great man, Sir Matt.
Yeah.
What was he like?
Well, in them days, when you signed, you used to go in, you cross the car park where the megastore is, then you'd go in the side door where Kath used to be on the side door. You'd go up the stairs. And that was roughly where the offices were. The top floor was, I think, Martin Edwards's. You very rarely got up there unless you were either signing or you were leaving. It was one of them. But then as you walked up into one of the levels, immediately as you went through the door, Sir Matt's door was right across, and it was always open, always. So, you know, we used to go up there match days. We'd turn left, go down to the grill room. But straight across from you, the first person you really saw after Kath was Sir Matt. And it always acknowledged, always. He always used to... Hi, son. Always. And, you know, I never really knew him, you know. It wasn't that I had, you know, a friendship with him because I was a player. But you just appreciated that moment. And then the enormity of it was after when I left playing and then I came back as a coach. Mm-hmm. Then you sort of inside it a little bit more on that level. And then obviously there's opportunities then to talk to, like, Sir Alex about, you know, he talked a lot about Sir Matt when he came to the club, Bobby Charlton, these types of people, and how they embraced him.
Yeah.
So then there's that continuation of stories, which is really good.
Would Sir Matt ever come down to the dressing room after games or anything?
Yeah, he did. He came down sometimes, and he'd always go around, shake your hand. Bobby was the same.
Yeah, I remember
Bobby. He would come down and shake your hand, and, you know, win, lose, or draw. They did that. Mm. And then on the bigger occasions, of course, Sir Matt would just sort of wish everybody good luck, and that was it. It was very quiet, unassuming guy in some ways. I always felt he appeared, he disappeared, he appeared, he disappeared. But the enormity of the presence of the guy really, really made you feel special.
I was going to ask, what was his presence like at that point? Because for me, and Helen will, I imagine, be the same, because of our age, he was just a mythical figure, because he'd already gone by the time we knew who he was. But when he was still alive and you were seeing him in his office and stuff, was he this huge titan legend of Manchester United, or just he was a manager and now he was there? Like what?
He just felt like a guy, you know, just another guy who'd achieved so much and was partly responsible for why I was there in a way, you know. He was very gentle. He seemed to be very gentle. I don't know about him as a coach or a manager. I never really asked that question, what he was like that way. But as a human being, he had time for you. He had time for everybody, really. You know, you know when somebody walks into a room and everybody goes, oh, he had that about him. You just go, oh. And that was really something that stays with you. It never leaves you. But I never really had many conversations with him, if any. You know, but I didn't need to. People told you about him. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. Supporters told you about him. You know, even my father, he knew of him. You know, and he knew of the George Bests of this world. And you know, I never saw them play. But you know, they talked about these people, even though my father wasn't a Manchester United supporter, he's a Burnley supporter. But he knew George Best. Oof, there you go. It's Matt Busby. And all these types of people. So Manchester United was a really prominent in a young footballer's mind.
Would you say your father is the reason that you had a love of football from a young age?
Yeah, my dad never played. I have a brother. He played a little bit, but my dad was a shift worker. He was a textile guy. Mm-hmm. The only time I really played football with my dad was when he was sort of doing the shifts in between sort of 2 till 10, 6 till 2. So we had an hour when we'd just go and play football with a lot of his mates we were working with. And that's really when I got involved in football. And my mother and my father, they supported me all through. Just like many, many parents do. And if you've got a little bit of talent. And then you just love playing football, don't you? You play 3 games a weekend and you've still got the dirt on your legs from the previous game, haven't you? And things like that. We did all that. And then eventually somebody comes along and thinks you're decent at it, so
you say that very casually, like eventually someone comes along. Let me tell you, they don't always come along. Some of us are very
well in those days. In those days, you always knew there was somebody watching you because they had a sheepskin coat on. So whoever had a sheepskin coat was usually a scout.
At what age were you when people started coming to watch? And at that point, were you thinking this could be my career? This is something I want to do with my life. Did you have any other aspirations?
No, I enjoyed playing football. I mean, I started playing probably around about 8, 9. And I started actually with a team. I live in the same village that I was brought up in. And my team at the time was just a street team. We played street teams. And it was 10 lads and a girl. And we just played and we were getting beat by, you know, this. I think one of the teams was called Higher Causeway Crack Shots. And
what was your team?
Broadway Place, I think it was called.
Broadway Place.
Yeah, something like that. And we just played. We played against each other, big lads against little lads and all that. And you just get battered, you know what I mean? I'm 9 years, 10 years of age, and you're just getting battered by seniors, really. And then I took an interest really in it because I started playing at school. And then obviously you'd be getting to your town teams, and we had local town teams then. And then it starts to get a little bit more exciting. And at 14, I was asked to go on trial to Burnley, which was my local club.
If you hadn't have made it in football, what was the backup?
I never really thought about it. When the moment came when I left school, I actually hadn't been told anything, you know, like I'm going to be an apprentice at Burnley or anything like that. And I was a little bit, where do you go from here? Do you go to college? Do you go to work?
What age was that? Was that 16?
Yeah, 16, yeah. 16. Yeah, so I was thinking, do I go in the forces? Do I try and learn to be a teacher? Because that seemed to be the next level that a lot of your mates were doing. They were going in the army or whatever. And I just thought, somebody please make a call and just tell me. And then it went on for about a week after I'd left school. I'm thinking all sorts of things. And then the call came, would you like to join Burnley FC as an apprentice? And it was like, not off, you know, I've got to do that. And it was like relief, real, real feeling of relief that I was going to be an apprentice at my hometown football club. £15 it was. I got 15 quid a week and I was rich. I was rich,
what
honestly.
What did you get as an apprentice?
£27.30.
Cash.
30.
Cash.
It was cash.
Cash.
Hey, in a little brown envelope, 15 quid.
Yeah.
And I think my mum and dad got 16 quid for Diggs money. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you give anything to your mum and dad?
No, the 16 quid was enough. It fed me three meals a day and made my bed.
You didn't actually get that much more, considering it was quite a long time after.
No. That was my first year apprenticeship. Second year went up to 35 quid.
Right.
18 bonus was £2 a win, pound draw. Reserve was...
You always knew you was doing well, especially after I was a year as an apprentice and then I broke into the team. But you always knew you were doing well because every Thursday the manager used to bring in a little brown bag, a little brown case, and that was the money in. And he used to come in and he used to dish it out, and you always knew you were doing well because your envelope was a little bit thicker. And he used to go, oh, brilliant. And he used to put it in my back pocket and take it all, divvy it out, and then sort of stick a little bit in the bank. Yeah, I put a little bit in the bank.
I knew you'd be
and
sensible.
I probably have a fiver in my pocket. Yeah. For the week, but it was enough.
Maisie definitely didn't save
it was
any
more
of his.
Than enough.
That's why he's doing the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So, at what point did that journey to earning your £15 a week become you're now a professional football player?
Well, I broke into Burnley's first team
as an apprentice.
As an apprentice, yeah.
Where are you playing at this point?
I was playing as a centre back.
As centre back.
Yeah. And I remember it vividly because there was a programme in England called Kickoff. And at that time, I think as an apprentice, they did a programme on two apprentices from two different clubs. There was me from Burnley and a guy who played at Oldham, Darren McDonough.
Yeah.
And it was going to be a comparison, so they followed us for a year.
Oh, wow.
And... you'll not get it on DVD. It's all VHS. You know what I mean?
We'll find it somewhere.
It's ancient. But they followed us for a year. And in fact, that was the first... Through that year, it was the first time I met Dennis Law. He narrated a little bit on it. And I went out with him for something to eat at the end of it all. And he sort of spoke to us. And Dennis always used to like a cup of tea. Always drank tea. And I always remember him saying, come here, son, sit down, have a cup of tea. Have a cup of tea. And we talked about, you know, and I'd known of Dennis, but he was a legend then, but he was doing this intro for it. And then the thing came out, and it was a combination of, I sort of pushed on and went in. Darren McDonough did the same at Oldham, but then he fell away, and I went the other way. So it was a great, great comparison. And, but my debut came through like anything, you know, you train in, and then on the Friday... I got a phone call. Well, I didn't get a phone call. The manager pulled me in the office, and we had a player called Jim Thompson, centre back, and he was an experienced guy, and he dropped out injured that afternoon. And I remember the manager saying, "You're in the squad. You turn up." And funny thing is, the kickoff cameras were actually. The morning of the game, my debut game, my mum and dad allowed the cameras in to the house. I didn't know they were there. I woke up literally and it's on the thing where I've just woke up and wow, you know, I've got a camera.
Camera in your face?
Honestly, yeah.
That's quite cool.
Well, they saw like snuck into your bedroom?
Yeah, they were there with a camera, yeah, and took the picture of me getting up. My mum woke me up that morning and it's like, wow, what's going on here? Like, you know what I mean? I can remember the supporters because I was a local boy. And the supporters loved it. Yeah. Local boy playing for the team and what have you. And to be honest, from that moment on, it just kept going up and up and up. Suffered a few injuries and stuff like that. But that was incredible. It was.
How soon after that then did you become professional?
Pretty much.
Would you have seen
right after it?
Right. Okay.
Yeah. It was sort
so
of.
So you
one
never
of those,
saw like saw your apprenticeship out.
No. No. It was more or less a done deal then. Once you get in and then.
And then what did you get then?
You get a bit extra then. I think I got about 50 quid, £50 a week, and then I was mega rich. Mm. You know what I mean?
So a good few years at Burnley, and then in 1985 you made the move to Norwich. How was it leaving Burnley, your boyhood club? How was your dad?
At that time, Burnley was up and down, really. Yeah. You know, we we were doing really well, then we got relegated, then we get back up. So my early career was sort of fluctuating between divisions. I actually met a guy, and you may have heard of the guy, Jimmy McElroy, very old player, played for England, and he was like the main man at Burnley over the years. My dad knew of him, watched him, but he was like the hero, like the George Best of Burnley. They named a stand after him, you know, at Burnley. And I never met him. And right at the end of that season, I went to a dinner and he was doing the speech, and he invited me over after the dinner and said, I want 5 minutes with you. And he used to write in the local paper in the golf scene. So I was like, oh, Jimmy, Matt, I've heard of you, my dad, and he sat me down. And the first thing he said to me was, you have to leave Burnley. And I was like, wow. It wasn't, hi, how are you doing? Yeah. I was like, you know you have to leave Burnley if you want to do better. And that stood with me. Mm-hmm. And then John Bond left the club and Norwich came right out of the blue. It was like, my first thoughts when somebody told, there was a caretaker in charge and he said, oh, Norwich want to buy you. And I was sitting there going, Norwich, where's that? Where's Norwich?
Yeah.
And believe you me, you say that, it's like going from Manchester to Malta. You know, it's middle of nowhere, out of the way.
It's actually quicker to get to Malta than it is to Norwich.
Tell me about it. Yeah. So I went and they said, well, we've agreed a fee, you know, go down and talk to them. And I was like, wow, yeah, well, I'll go and talk to them. I don't know where it is. And you know, when you go into somewhere, it just felt really good. And I remember it well, because I said to my girlfriend at the time, was Bridget, and I said, I'll just go down and have a chat and I'll get back. You know what I mean? Anyway, I came back and I told her that I'd signed for Norwich. So it was a real jump for me. But I moved out of home, you know, out of mum and dad, and I went down there for a year. Living rough, really, for a year, because that's what you did. I was sleeping on mattresses with a couple of the players and stuff like that. We were just slumming it, really. But it was a great year, a really good year. It was we got promoted because they won the Milk Cup and then they got relegated that year. And Steve Bruce was there, Chris Woods, the goalkeeper, Dave Watson. There was quite a number of good players that they kept that year, having got relegated. And we got automatically promoted.
Yeah, because at this point you've won a Division 3 medal with Burnley.
Yes.
Division 2 now with Norwich. There is no Premier League, so
that's right.
First Division is what comes next. Just because of time, we'll now skip the rest of the time at Norwich.
Thanks for coming, Mike.
Get to Manchester United, which I think is what everyone's more interested in. When did that move come about, and what were your feelings around the time, and how old were you?
I can't remember how old I was. I can remember the moment though. I was in my garden at the end of the. I was injured at the end of the season for Norwich, and my contract was coming up.
You were about 26,
yeah, like good age.
Yeah, great age.
And I was thinking about, do I stay? Because I could have, if I'd have signed again there, I would have stayed for the rest of my life. It was one of those places where, and I was captain at the time, and I was in my garden before I was going to training one morning. I only lived a mile, Norwich in them days, living a mile outside of the city, it's the countryside, you know what I mean? I was in the garden and I got a phone call, and Bridget, my wife, opened the kitchen window and she's going, call for you, there's a fella on the line, I can't understand a word he's saying, but he says he's from Manchester United. And I was in the garden, I went, nah, you're having a laugh, you know what I mean? That's not possible. So she said, no, it's a guy, you better take it, you know, you better take it. Anyway, it was Sir Alex on the phone, and he was sort of saying, hiya, son. And he said the same, hiya, son. And I went, yeah, yeah. He said, Sir Alec. He wasn't a sir then.
Yeah.
He said,
It's
Alec. I'm thinking, Alec? Alec who? Alec Ferguson, Manchester United. I went, yeah, all right, okay. He says, would you be interested in having a chat with us? And I went, yeah, why not? And we still were in the season, you know, and we were actually our last... I think it was the second to last game we were playing in Sheffield. And I was injured, but he said, right, Sheffield, you're playing Sheffield, Wednesday it was. And he says, right, we'll arrange something, I'll get back in touch with you. So I travelled up to Sheffield with the team, and I got a phone call saying, we're coming to Sheffield. I said, who's coming? He said, him and Archie Knox. We're driving to Sheffield, and we'll see you at the hotel. And I went, oh.
Where you were staying with Norwich?
Yeah, yeah. And then I went, well, we haven't got there. We're still on the bus then. And the daft thing was, we turned up at Sheffield. We went in the hotel. I remember called the Hallam Towers, I think it was called, the hotel. As you went in reception, who was in reception was the Sheffield Wednesday team and Ron Atkinson sat in the reception. So I've gone in, I've got my bag, gone to the room, whatever, then I get the call. Apparently what happened, Archie Knox had come into the hotel and seen them all sat there. And so he's phoned me up and gone, get yourself out in the car park. And he talked on the car park, can't come inside and all that. And it was weird. And then I got in the car and we drove off somewhere and then he just said, right.
So hang on, this is you,
this is me, Archie and Sir Alex.
In the car, driving off somewhere?
Just driving into middle of nowhere. And then it was like, right, here we go. And then he just said, do you want to join Manchester United?
Were you in the back?
I was in the back. You can make this scene into a TV thing.
It's a bit like a kidnapping.
Right. It was just hostage. Surreal. And then I'm thinking, wow, what am I doing in here? You know. And then this guy's saying, do you want to join? And I said, yeah, it would be really interesting to join. And then that was it. He said, right, we'll be in touch. Drop me back at the hotel. And that was it. And then once the season finished, we got together and what have you. But the funny thing about when I signed, it was I had Arsenal were interested at one point, but I didn't fancy London. And then Everton and Man U. And Everton at the time, Colin Harvey was the manager. And it worked out that I went to talk to Everton in the morning that I was talking in the afternoon to Manchester United. So I went to Everton, talked. It was fantastic. I loved Everton. I loved playing at Everton. And I thought, wow. And I drove then back from Everton to Old Trafford. I got out of the car park again, that's there across from the Megastore, walk across the car park to go in. As I'm walking in, Martin Keown's walking out. So we shake hands, say hi. He says, oh, I've just been talking to Manchester United. I went, yeah, I'm going in now to have a natter. And he said, and I'm going to Everton. I said, I've just come for Everton. And he says, I'm going to Everton. He signed for Everton, and I signed for Man U. It was unbelievable.
So that conversation that you
and
had,
I won everything, and he struggled for his life.
Was that, how many, what month would that have been?
That would be probably end of May, June.
Right, okay, yeah. So it maybe wasn't too long. But did you have to keep that to yourself until they officially signed you?
No, because I think then your contract ran until June 30th,
June
weren't
30th,
it?
Yeah.
So you could sign after that, but everything was done more or less before that. And then they informed Norwich and what have you. But my contract was up, so it was literally courtesy to just sort of get the clubs to talk to each other, and then it went from there,
And obviously you knew Steve Bruce there?
Yeah, I knew Steve. It's one of those occasions when it was empty. The place was empty. There's nobody there. Martin Edwards was in his office. Sir Alex met me, took me up to his office, and then we had a little chat about things. But I remember sitting in the grill room. I didn't know it was the grill room at the time, but scampi in a basket we got, scampi and chips in a basket. But looking out onto the field, it was empty. There was nobody there, absolutely nobody there. But it was one of those weird moments when everybody was there. I just remember looking out the window and thinking, this is full. You know, and then you get the idea of the Theatre of Dreams and all that. It literally felt as though eyes were watching you, and it's empty, the place. And I always remember I was really keen on Everton, really keen. More money on offer at Everton. But just being there, and again, that prickly sensation, I just thought, I've got to have a go at this. I really got to have a go at this. And at that time, United were, you know, they were just finding their feet, really. Yeah. They were, I think Sir Alex had been in the job a couple of years.
A lot of pressure on him as well.
Yeah, but doing it was the best thing. You know, just being satisfied with signing for Manchester United and then getting on with it. And it was completely different to Norwich, completely different.
What the standards of professionalism?
Well, it was like, it goes back to what we started with, the historical side of it. You know, I remember, you know, always people talking about Manchester United, but it was just that feeling of being part of something. And I was always a believer of, if you don't give it a go, you never know. You'll never find out. So I jumped in. And the enormity of Manchester United actually hit me when that first season, I think the pre-season tour was Asia. and it was Bangkok and Thailand, and getting off that plane in Bangkok, and there's like 3,000 people mm-hmm. at the airport, all, you know, thought the Beatles again, you know what I mean? It was the Beatles, and but they're all screaming and shouting, and it was remarkable. So that was then when you realised, wow, this is pretty special.
Yeah.
Pretty special. And it was an up and down sort of first season.
Well, it had a good up at the end, didn't it? You won the FA Cup.
We won the FA Cup, yeah. Some say that kept Sir Alex in his job, but I don't think that was the case. But we did struggle. We actually won the first game against Arsenal. We smashed Arsenal, first game at home. Remember it well. And then we went on a really poor run. I think we were down, we could have slipped into the bottom three at one point, I think. But then the FA Cup took us to the next level, really.
When it comes to Sir Alex, in this instance, you say about that kept him in his job, you've got an insight that no one else will have. What was the Alex Ferguson like that hadn't won a trophy yet compared to the one you would then work with years later, who was a Knight of the Realm and had won bags of trophies?
As a manager, he was tough. He was aggressive, weren't he? Mm-hmm. He could be aggressive. He could be nice as pie, but he could be more times than not aggressive. And he really had, he had a way about him where, because he'd selected you and brought you in, he had a lot of faith in you. And you always felt as though you never wanted to let him down, because he'd give you the opportunity in the first place. So he had you. He had you, either you play or you don't play. You know what I mean? And the only way to keep playing was to play well.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? He had that sort of approach. And Archie Knox, his assistant, was good that way as well. I mean, they were two fiery guys, them two together. Yeah. They could argue with each other for fun, and it was a show in itself watching them talk. But in the main, it was, this is what we want to do, this is how we want to do it, and we're going to go for it. Mm. And that first year was turbulent. Mm. It was turbulent. And the memories and you as supporters and what have you, it was a kind of pressure where we haven't won. Mm. We haven't won the league, and we haven't, you know, this club needs to be at the top again, and you're never as good as, you know, the past players. That was always rammed down your throat.
Yeah.
You'll never be as good as them, you never... And then once we got on the cup run and we won the cup, everything changed. The belief in the dressing room, the playing side of things, it was like, right, we want to do something again, we want to go again, we want to go again. And it just that jigsaw puzzle came together and it just moved forward all the time. And we built on something.
What did it mean to you personally to win the FA Cup?
Oh, that was a dream, because as a kid, you know, I remember the FA Cup final day on a Saturday used to start at 7 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah.
And it used to be kids shows and everything, you know, both teams, and then the
cameraman in the bedroom.
Cameraman, yeah. Cameraman, well, the cameraman there in them days was on the team bus going to the ground and everything.
Unbelievable.
So it was a whole day. You know, you get to that age where you're sort of an apprentice or even before that. Oh, I'd love to have a look at that. Wembley Twin Towers. It was a fantastic.
Had you been to Wembley before?
I'd only been to London once ever in my life.
What?
As a kid, as a player, and I went to Lewisham to play a team in Lewisham.
Right.
And that was the first time I'd ever done it. And then the FA Cup final was the first time I'd ever been to Wembley.
What about, like, away at Arsenal or Chelsea or...?
No.
Really?
That's mental, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I played after that, but when Wembley, for me, winning the FA Cup was all about the dream of being a kid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What do you actually remember about that day? Is there something that sticks in your mind, or...?
I remember...
Was you nervous?
I wasn't nervous, no. It was more... I wanted just to enjoy the moment, soak it all up. So I never really felt nervous. In all the finals I played in, to be honest, I was always smiley and happy to be there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It was one of them, just happy to be there. Because you don't realise how much work goes into actually trying to get to those finals, let alone win them. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And you know, it happened a lot in my career where... I just thought, I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm going to enjoy the moment and play the game. And most of the finals I can't remember. I can remember afterwards. Mm-hmm. I can remember a bit before, but I can't remember the game. And to be honest, I've never watched that final again. I've never watched the Cup Winners' Cup final again. Honestly, I've never. Oh. Just it's there. It's in my head.
Have you not seen that interview with Pauly? Watched that so many times. Yeah. No, that interview just goes unbelievable. And it just repeats that. Have you never seen that?
I've not seen it.
Everything's unbelievable.
I just kept in my head moving on. It was like, move on, done it, brilliant, want to do it again. And that was my approach to it all the time, and just trying to make sure I was in the right frame of mind and the right physical condition to be able to be given that opportunity again. So it was literally, the only time I really reflected was when I came out of coaching at Man United when Sir Alex retired, and I had about 16 months when I didn't do anything, because it was like a roller coaster of just training, playing, sorting the team out and everything. And then I actually went about 12 months later, 14 months later, I did a presentation evening, and the compere sort of introduced me and read out the list of honours that I'd had. And I was like, really? It was like, wow, that's not bad, that, you know what I mean? Yeah. But I'd never thought about it. I'd never thought about that at the time.
I'm going to do that again now, because in a minute we're going to take some questions from the audience. So before we finish with you, I think we should do that and go through what you actually won, and you can tell us what that was like.
See if you've missed anything.
As a player or a coach?
As a player. So for those player, that are listening, and for those of you in the audience, Mick has been on the podcast before, and it was a special episode where we just talked about your life as a coach, whereas this one, obviously, we've talked about the player. So, football third division, football second division, Premier League, FA Cup, League Cup, Charity Shield, European Cup, Winners' Cup. Everything pretty much but the first division.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one I couldn't get, but I did that as a coach, so...
Yeah.
It's funny when you get on that sort of merry-go-round and what have you, once you've achieved a bit of success and once you've enjoyed that moment, because we celebrated, didn't we, when we won, we celebrated, you know, it just went on and on and on, didn't it?
Yeah.
And so it should. It's that moment where everything comes together, and then there's a moment where you go, right, calm down now, get back to the job and let's do it again. And that was always instilled in us as players, and certainly as coaches and players, do you want to do it again? Do you want to go again? Right, you've had your fun, you've got the medal, done, let's go and do it again. And that was the challenge all the time. And that stayed with me throughout my coaching side as well, you know, just wanting to go on that journey again and win. And then it took you to the next level, and coaching then takes you into a different environment, but it certainly coaching, managing is a different kettle of fish. But to actually win things again when you're doing that. I mean, I appreciated things that the manager did when I was... I didn't appreciate it when I was a player, sometimes what the manager did, like leaving you out or dropping you or, you know, sort of all those sorts of things. But then when you went into coaching and managing, all that thing, all those questions were answered, if you understand. So, because I was in that environment of decision-making and why he would do something like that. And got understanding of it then, but it was all part and parcel of it, and how hard it is, you know. Sir Alex always used to say it's hard to pick a football team for Manchester United because everybody could play, everybody, and he didn't enjoy doing it. You could see that all through his career, but he made the big decisions, and that was his strength, really. You could make a decision and stick by it, and you were in. You were never out, funnily enough. It was like you were in, but you were part of something. Mm-hmm. And he made those people that weren't playing regularly really special.
He's well known for that, isn't he? Did he always do that himself, or were you ever sent to go and tell a player that they were left?
There was an instance. This is when I was a player, and then as an assistant, as a coach. And when you were a player, you get to the club 3 hours before. You'd have your grill room, something to eat, go down to the dressing room, because you had to do, because of the crowd, you couldn't get in otherwise. And as a player, you'd go into the dressing room for the team meeting, and he never told the team until, like, probably an hour and a quarter before kick-off. So you'd all be sitting there, and them days were all suited and booted and everything. So we're all sitting waiting. But before the game, before he went into the meeting, he used to send Brian Kidd from his office into the dressing room, and he literally would look around Brian and he'd go,
curly finger.
And everybody, that, you know, was like, here we go, you know what I mean? Yeah. And I became that guy when I was a coach. He used to send me in to do the curly finger to others. He wants to see you, and he wants to see you. And but he.
So you would call them in to see him?
Yeah, he'd say, get me so and so, get me so and so. Gaffer wants a word. Oh, this is going to be a good word.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And then they'd go have a word, come back, and they'd either be all right, or they'd be like, here we go.
Yeah.
Not playing.
Yeah.
And then he'd come in and name the team.
Well, I don't want to be that guy, because I feel like we could do this forever, because your stories are wonderful. But we're gonna stop asking our questions now, and we're going to hand over to the audience and let you guys ask some questions if you want to.
So my question is actually going to take me back to from where you started, Mike.
Okay.
You mentioned change from when you first came to Malta in 1991 to now. You've seen, you know, big change. The same change is happening in the football, no? From when the time that you and David played to the how the game is played today. How do you view that change in sense of, I mean, let's take a recent example. In the game against Wolves, the penalty that we suffered, that we conceded, I mean, do you view that as, you know, better that you play in the football, the way the football matches, football game is being played today, or you prefer the rawness of the football game that you played in?
I certainly enjoyed when we played, because you could kick people.
I was waiting for you to say that. I knew it was
well,
one,
you could kick people, they would get up straight away, you'd get kicked, you'd get up. The penalty incident, it's just, one thing I hate is seeing people diving. And for the minuscule of touch, whatever it was, and the way he dived, you know, it's just horrible to watch. And then you have to wait 2 minutes, 3 minutes for VAR, and it just kills the game. It's so much better now when I watch, like, the FA Cup, yeah, and the team that's at home doesn't have VAR, I think the game is so much better. The referees are there to make decisions. Just make the decision and get on with it. And that's how you have to live with it. Now it's so different. So I prefer the old school, certainly.
I think from my personal point of view, over the number of years of growing through it and then going on to the other side sort of thing, the coaching and managing, technology's played a big part in the different parts of the game, really. Everything's scrutinised more. You know, we all have mobile phones now. They were never there in my day. It was literally camera, video,
yeah,
watch the game, rewind it, go again. Nowadays, it's instantaneous. So everything is pretty more reactive, which creates noise and media coverage, bigger media coverage. Everybody's massively opinionated. In my playing days, opinions were shared by supporters after the game, probably having a beer, you know, and talking about the game and then going home and going to work again and things like that, looking forward to the next game. Now it's consistently there. So everybody has a say in things, and that can, you know, how many times have we sat and read something and gone, wow, did that really happen? Because that didn't happen when I was there, you know, watching. And so there's a lot of that. The game itself has changed to a degree in, I wouldn't say fitness levels, because I always felt we were fit as fleas,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
and we burnt the candle. You know, we liked to drink. You know, we had that culture. Now they don't do half of that, if any of that, and they're still fit. Yeah, they might be quicker. Maybe the tactical elements changed a little bit, but all in all, it's still 11v11. It's still competitive. There's more scrutiny than ever before. You can't get away from that now, and I think that creates the, if I can call it, the product of football now.
That's a great question. Yeah. Yes, go ahead, Joe.
A question from curiosity. I presume Maisie has already replied this maybe in previous episodes of the podcast, but David and Mike, who was the best player that you have played with in your career, and who was the hardest opponent you have faced in your career?
Player to play with would have been Eric Cantona. I mean, sometimes he would just... he'd been missing in games, and then it just come up something so special. And whether it's 2 foot in the lad in the crowd at Crystal Palace, he was always going to do something special. Player against, I mean, Shearer was up there. Zidane, there's a few. Physically, I wasn't really bothered about playing against Fashanu or anybody like that. They would just battle. Duncan Ferguson, horrible to play against. But I loved the battle. I did.
For me, Brian Robson, playing with Brian Robson. In my youth, when I first broke in at Burnley, it was Martin Dobson was my hero. But Brian Robson was someone special to play alongside. There's been quite a few. Brian McClair was great to play with. Chocky had a way about him where he was probably the worst trainer at the football club, hated training, but on match day, poof, he covered the ground. He was all over the place, you know. I think he ran on lager, really, or cider. He was so full of
us.
So full of it, but an exceptional player. So for me, probably Brian Robson to play with. Actually play against. Players, when you were younger, you always looked up to players. When I was younger, I played against Kevin Keegan, believe it or not, at Burnley. He was playing for Newcastle, and it was down at Turf Moor, and he turned up, and I was centre-back, and he was playing. So that was, he'd just come back from Hamburg, I think it was. So that was like one of those moments, Kevin Keegan, wow, you know, playing, even coming to Burnley and playing, but playing against him. So that was an interesting one. When I was at United, I played in a game where we, Atletico Madrid, and it was Paulo Futre, and he gave me twisted blood. Him, to be fair, he was cunning and cute, and I just thought he was outstanding. Again, when I was a young kid at Burnley, breaking through, I played a few games in the reserves, and in them days, the league was mirrored by. So if Burnley were playing Manchester United at Manchester United, Manchester United reserves were playing Burnley at Burnley, and I played in the reserves against Manchester United. And I played against the Greenough, are they twins, brothers?
Yeah, brothers. Yeah.
Brothers. And they were. It was a lesson as a kid. It was a lesson. And they just did things. They were selling me for a bag of crisps. You know, I was going for a bag of crisps, and they were passing it away. And it was all part of the learning curve. And I always remember Arnold Muren. I played against him. I actually played against Norman Whiteside as a kid when he was a kid. That was at the Cliff in the A team then. It was like A and B teams. Yeah. And they were flying him in from Northern Ireland every game to play. And he was 15 years of age, I think he was. Yeah. But he was a monster.
He looked about 30,
yeah.
He was a
monster.
Again, I'm going to do the boring bit, which is we have to finish. But thank you all so much for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for asking questions.
Bang.
For those listening,
best
that was great.
Ever.
I handed a balloon.
They had to. Obviously, you've seen the thing. I wish I had a pound for every time.
Yeah, no,
this is cool. But you know, at the game, I remember it really, really well because I was sat in the dugout. The game's going on, but I could just before the game started, there was a couple of balloons, and this balloon. If I'm sitting here and the game's going on down here, and I remember seeing this balloon, and you know when something gets in your head and it stays in your head, this balloon stayed in my head, and I thought, if that balloon comes near me, it's having it. And it was as if I'd sucked it towards me, and it was coming along, and the game's going on, and all of a sudden I just grabbed it, put it down, and I went bang. Well, he absolutely wet himself. He jumped, and it was all, and I was laughing my head off. I was literally laughing.
As was Rennie.
And I wasn't interested in the game at all. And I'm thinking, I'm bloody coach here, like I'm assistant manager, and I'm wetting myself. I remember it well because I thought, that's me done. I'm finished. Tomorrow I'll be out.
Before I die.
Then I saw it again, and obviously it got played over and over again. And the next morning, Sir Alex called me into his office. And he tried to be serious about, you know, having a go at me for it and all that. But he had that cheeky smile on his face. And he started laughing. And what helped was his grandchildren had seen it. And they thought it was really funny that their grandfather had had this experience.
So they saved your job, basically.
So they more or less kept me in work, yeah. But it was just one of those magic moments.
It's a great video.
Brilliant.